Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the HMEB podcast. I'm your host, David Cuff, the executive editor of HME Business Magazine, your source for news, trends, and insights into the home medical equipment industry. Women's health is a key market segment for many providers, and it faces its own unique challenges in terms of business management, care, and regulation. On that latter point, this podcast comes at an auspicious time. Just recently, March 8th marked International Women's Day, and right before that, we had pivotal women's health legislation introduced into the House and Senate. Here to talk about that legislation is Nikki Jensen, the Vice President of Essentially Women, a member service organization that helps HME providers that specialize in women's health. Nikki, welcome. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you for having me, David.
Absolutely. Great to talk to you again. Let's talk about this legislation. Just a thumbnail description. What is the act that's been introduced and why is it important?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got the Breast Cancer Patient Equity Act, and this has been introduced into Congress. And the gist of this is that it is legislation that will allow Medicare to recognize custom breast prosthesis as an eligible benefit for women who've had mastectomy surgery.
And that's huge because I think somebody put it well. One of the senators, and that is that this is like the one piece of the body that is not covered by Medicare.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that was an opportunity that we had also as we met last summer. The VGM Government Relations Department and I had a meeting with two ombudsmen, and we met with them to discuss the opportunity for them to take a regulatory approach and just fix that interpretation that they had regarding breast prosthesis, that they would allow custom breast prosthesis. And their response back to us at that point was that they didn't see the medical necessity because there wasn't any increase in functionality. At that point, they actually asked us if there was any other body part that we could reference that Medicare allowed custom replacement for that didn't increase functionality. We actually gave them the examples of an eye and an ear because those are the other body parts that we could find that didn't increase functionality. So to our research and such that we found, there really isn't any other body part that Medicare doesn't allow as a custom replacement.
And yet so clearly this is an important issue for post-mastectomy patients because you know, it really is something that helps them continue with their lives regardless of perhaps mechanical functionality or something like that. Just in terms of actual life, it's got to be something that's huge to those patients.
Oh, absolutely. There's, you know, certainly great you know, situations and opportunities for an off-the-shelf prosthetic to be a great solution for women. But we know that for those women who maybe don't have a flat chest wall after surgery, or if they're trying to match symmetry to an existing breast, or if they're looking to match skin tone, an off-the-shelf breast prosthetic doesn't always meet the requirements that they're looking for. So for those cases, we really believe that a custom prosthetic would be a better opportunity for them to move forward with, you know, their life after cancer.
And this is an effort that you started actually last year, correct? You introduced legislation in the House and Senate to get this to basically effect the same thing, right?
Correct. And actually, the first time this bill was introduced was back in 2011.
Oh my gosh!
And yeah, so Senator Olympia Snowe and Congressman Ross from Arkansas had introduced this bill, very similar version to it, in 2011 in the 112th Congress. At the end of that kind of campaign cycle or that Congress, neither one of them came back to office. And so we're not really sure why the bill wasn't picked back up again or why it didn't get passed at that time. But we definitely saw that there was great opportunity for us to kind of revive that bill and bring it back. And so we worked with legislative offices last year. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, met with two ombudsmen at CMS to see if there was an opportunity for us to do a regulatory fix. But at that time, they basically told us that the only way that we were going to be able to change things from CMS's perspective is through legislation. So last fall, we did succeed in getting both the House and the Senate bills introduced. We knew it was very late in the game with regards to the 115th Congress. So essentially it became a placeholder for making it easier for us to get an early introduction in this year. So now, you know, we've got the new Congress underway. It is the 116th Congress. And as of February 26th, we have both bills dropped. Both of them dropped on the very same day. So that was very exciting for us.
Absolutely. And again, going back to the purpose of this bill, this is a really important fight in terms of women's health. And it sounds to me like you've got some really solid congressional champions this time around. Maybe we could talk about some of those lawmakers.
Absolutely. In the Senate, we have Senator Tammy Duckworth from Illinois and Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. That bill number is S-562. And then in the House, we have H.R. 1370, and that's led by Representative Judy Chu from California and Representative Jackie Walorski from Indiana.
And it seems to me that out of the box, when both the bills dropped, these guys were really championing this issue. The public statements that each of those lawmakers released was very definitive in their support of this legislation and this need for these patients.
Yes, absolutely. They've been tremendous advocates, and working with their offices has been a great pleasure. They all get it, and their offices were very good at communicating with each other and coordinating this effort for us. So we're very grateful to have all of them on our side with this.
And speaking of advocacy, you guys have the campaign Let Her Decide. Maybe you could tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that bills are only passed by grassroots advocates, people out in communities sharing the messages. And so we created a toolkit, and it all is based off of the campaign of Let Her Decide. So we have a landing page at letherdecide.org. This is officially housed on our People for Quality Care. It's a patient advocacy site, so it's officially housed there, but it's an opportunity to share that education, what this bill is about, why it's necessary, and then it gives an opportunity for people to take action. So in order for our legislators to know that these bills are important to us, they have to hear from us. So with this, when you click the Take Action button on the letherdecide.org site, it takes you to a separate page where it asks for you to enter in your home zip code, and from there it populates your legislators. And so it can send an email directly to your senators and your representative to let them know that you as a constituent are asking for their support on this bill.
Could it get any easier?
I don't think so. It's an email that's already been drafted. It does give you an opportunity to edit it if you'd like, but if you want to just keep it simple and just put in your home address and your name and click submit, it's all done.
Terrific. Well, Nikki, what can providers do if they want to find out more information about this issue and about advocating on behalf of the legislation?
Absolutely. We'd love to share with people our advocacy toolkit. We know that it's hard to know where to start or what to do first. So we've created the grassroots advocacy toolkit. Inside, there's things like talking points for supporting this legislation, how to engage with local media. There's a sample press release. There's outreach materials that can be printed and used as handouts. We have an infographic that can be posted in their locations or left with referral sources. And we also have counter cards that can be copied. It's a front and back kind of master copy that people can use to share with customers to be able to share the message. So with that, they can contact us at essentiallywomen@vgm.com. Just send us an email and let us know that you're interested, and we'd be happy to, you know, share our advocacy toolkit to help share this message.
And what about social media?
Yeah, absolutely. We also have a Facebook page at Let Her Decide. And we have a Twitter account at Let Her Decide as well. So both of those will be engaged with social media, and we're definitely looking for people to, you know, share the message again within their own friends, with their communities, and get the message going. Because as much as we can share this across the country, the closer we'll be to passing this legislation.
All right. Well, Nikki, thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about this legislation and about this important issue.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, David. We appreciate it.
One issue facing all providers is Medicare claims audits. And one audit program that's coming to the fore is the six-year look-back program. I got a chance to interview well-known audit expert Wayne Van Halem about this topic, but before I dive in and play that interview for you, I want to give you a heads up that due to some technical difficulties, the quality of that interview is not as good as I had hoped it would be. That said, Wayne is clear as a bell, and what he has to say is critical to your business.
I'm here talking with Wayne Van Halem, the president and founder of the Van Halem Group, which is an industry audit consulting firm that most people in the industry know. The Van Halem Group helps providers contend with the tricky issues related to Medicare claims audits. Wayne, how you doing?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
I'm all right. Thanks for being here. So we're talking about an important topic, and that is the six-year look-back audits. This represents a very different take on audits in the past from what Medicare has done. Maybe a good place to start would be to get a description of these audits. What is the six-year look-back program, Wayne?
Yeah, sure. So it's something that essentially came out of the Affordable Care Act. And essentially, Section 6402 of the Affordable Care Act says that any supplier or provider that receives an overpayment must report it to CMS and provide written notice of that overpayment, and they have to do that within 60 days. Everyone's pretty familiar with the 60-day payment rule. What they're not familiar with is the six-year look-back, which is a part of that. And essentially what the law also states is that if they'd identified an overpayment, that they, you know, have a benchmark of 180 days or 6 months to conduct an investigation and go back 6 years to determine if that overpayment also is applicable to other claims submitted within that time period.
Wow. And where did this come out of?
So it was written as law into the Affordable Care Act, and you know, I think the intent was to notify suppliers or providers that, you know, they get an overpayment, then they have to refund it, and you want to make sure that refund, you know, if the overpayment doesn't impact other claims. And that makes sense. And in the initial language in the rule, it was actually a 10-year look back. And they came back and said that that was too much of a burden. So they reduced it to 6 years, but still a pretty significant burden on providers. And now we're seeing the government using this as a tool in the audits that they're doing in requiring providers and suppliers to perform their own 6-year look backs.
And I think you had mentioned that this initially came out of a study that was based on a fairly small sample size that was then extrapolated up. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so I guess our first hint of this happening was back last year when they had released the results of a ventilator audit that the OIG had done. And the ventilator audit was, they didn't request records from any suppliers. They simply looked at claims data, and they then identified three particular areas where they think claims would have been overpaid. One is when a ventilator was billed with an obstructive sleep apnea diagnosis. Another, when there were claims for multiple pieces of equipment that were billed during the same rental month. And then the other is when there were supplies that were billed in accordance with rental, which wouldn't be allowed. In that report, they came out with these findings and said, we've identified these potential overpayments. But then went to the contractors and in their review said to that one of their recommendations was that the contractors alert these entities for them to perform their own review of these specific claims to see if there was an overpayment. So that was the first indication where they're sort of putting the responsibility onto the supplier to do their own internal audit and then report it back. The next report that we saw of significance in the DME industry was the PAP report that came out in June of last year, which essentially, you know, the title of the report says it all. Most Medicare claims for replacement PAP supplies did not comply with Medicare requirements. So they did an audit of about 110 claims, which is, you know, out of I forget the entire sample during the time period, but I think it was over 7 million claims. And they looked at 110, and out of those 110, they said 86 of them did not meet Medicare requirements, and as a result, they feel there's an extrapolated overpayment of $631.3 million for PAP supplies. So they then recommended, as part of their recommendations in their report, that contractors collect the overpayments, but then they also included some language in there that said, instruct the Medicare contractors to notify those suppliers to exercise their reasonable due diligence to investigate and return any overpayments in accordance with the 60-day rule. So they sent letters to the suppliers, and in the letters, it explains the 60-day rule. And the 60-day rule includes the fact that they have to go back to identify overpayments within 6 years of the date the overpayment was received. So they sent these letters out to suppliers throughout the country. There were about 82 of them that got them. And these suppliers are now having to go through the process of performing a six-year look back. In addition, you know, think about PAP supplies and the volume of claims that are getting submitted during a six-year period. They told these suppliers that they either had to look and prove to CMS that they looked at 100% of their claims for a period of 6 years for all PAP supplies for all patients for Medicare, or they had to pull a statistically valid random sample explaining to CMS their sampling methodology and then extrapolate the results and refund an extrapolated overpayment. So that's why this is such a sort of a significant issue, because a lot of these suppliers, you know, there were 82 suppliers and 86 claims. So most suppliers only had one claim in this audit, and it's going from one claim to them having to look back 6 years at every single claim or do a sample and extrapolate, which, as we know, most suppliers don't have, you know, a statistician on staff that has that expertise. So they're having to hire a third party to help them in this regard. So that's really where we started seeing this coming out from the government. There was another one that was pretty interesting on bracing, and it was on a specific provider. And that it was a company out on the West Coast called Pacific Braces, and they did an audit with them, and they audited 100 claims, and they found that 89 of the 100 actually complied with Medicare requirements, which is a pretty darn good outcome. But there were 11 claims denied. And out of those 11 claims, they extrapolated those results to show that the company owed them almost $250,000, and now they're also requiring that company to do a six-year look back. So they, you know, it's clearly the new route that they are going is by taking this rule from the Affordable Care Act and then applying it to all these audits that they're performing.
You know, this sounds wild to me, Wayne, and, you know, for the folks in the audience who may not know, Wayne has a deep background working within CMS's program integrity efforts before he struck out to work with HME providers and help them. The thing that seems kind of wild to me is that it seems like they're taking a few kind of examples here and then extrapolating them way out to a much, much larger number of claims.
Yeah, I certainly think, you know, the sample size in some of these, you know, certainly the PAP one, you know, comes into question, but people have questioned them on that, and they've provided their, you know, sampling methodology, and you know, essentially you can take a small sample size and make it, you know, reflective of the universe as long as there's an appropriate sampling methodology, which they did. So while I think it's still, you know, a really, I don't think they did a great job in these reviews. I mean, we think they've made some errors in there. So certainly I call into question the audit in general. But the reality is that some of these suppliers only had one claim. And going from one claim to a six-year look back is really a pretty significant jump. And one that folks at CMS tend to seem to tend to agree with us. However, they have their authority over the OIG and what the OIG instructs contractors and the like to do. So CMS is sort of has their hands tied, and you know, suppliers are being forced into this. In some cases we've seen the claims actually get overturned in the appeal process, which, you know, shows that the OIG maybe didn't do their review accurately.
So what's the upshot for the providers here? You know, what do they need to start doing, and what kind of timetables are they looking at?
So there is no upshot for the providers that unfortunately got these letters. There have been some that, you know, and we're working with a number of them that, you know, we've been able to get the claim that was in the audit overturned in the appeal process. And I do think CMS is going to provide some instruction along the lines that, you know, if the claim was overturned, the supplier doesn't have to do the look back. But that's not happening in all their cases, which means, you know, the supplier then has to go down this path of developing a plan with a team of folks that they've engaged to perform this look back. And what we're recommending, and here's where, you know, the significant challenge comes in, and everyone knows I'm not an attorney, but there are legal implications of this, because what the Affordable Care Act says is that if the supplier fails to self-report an overpayment and refund it in accordance with the Affordable Care Act, then they're subject to civil monetary penalties under the Federal False Claims Act. So we're talking about very serious actions that could be taken down the road. So, for example, if a provider or supplier got one of these letters instructing them to do a six-year look back, and they just decide either they're not going to do it or they're not going to do it the way in which the government would expect they would do it, and they don't self-report or they don't self-report enough, and the government looks at their report later on down the road and makes a determination they didn't do what they were supposed to do, they can be subject to civil penalties under false claims, which is really scary. So what our recommendation and anyone who's getting these letters is that you first engage legal counsel to assist you, and that's every one of the suppliers that we're working with, we're engaged through their law firm, because there's got to be some sort of legal protection there because of the potential impact on suppliers down the road. So not only is it a big deal to have to go through this audit and do this work now within the time period allotted, which was, you know, you had 6 months to do the audit and 2 months to refund it back, so 8 months you have to do this. Not only do you have to do that, which is a significant burden, but then you also have to worry about, you know, what's your liability down the road, which is pretty scary.
And what about for the providers that not receiving their letters, is there anything that they can do to prepare in the event that they might receive a letter? Or, well, maybe there isn't, I don't know.
No, sure. I mean, you know, reality is right now they should, you know, thank their lucky stars that they didn't receive one of the letters. All the letters have gone out, and the 82 suppliers that are due to get them have gotten them. So, and we know some folks that were, you know, had claims that were, you know, in that sample that didn't get overpaid or didn't get recouped, and they're very, very thankful. But, you know, I think the most important thing, and this kind of goes hand in hand, you know, one of the reasons this is so frustrating that the government is doing this is because, you know, part of what our practice is and what, you know, the government encourages people to do is be proactive and do audits and check yourself on a regular basis. They require that through, you know, other parts of the Affordable Care Act. But then they're saying, you know, if you find an issue that you have to go back 6 years, and that's not really what I think the intent of the rule was. You know, for providers who haven't gotten that letter, you know, my recommendation is, one, be familiar with the OIG work plan. So the OIG used to release their work plan on an annual basis only. So this is what they're going to look at throughout the year. Now they post things on as they are reviewing them, they post things. And this is why this is so important, because I feel fairly confident that any OIG report that gets released from this point forward, if it is, you know, if there's overpayments identified either on a specific provider or on a specific, you know, codes or something along those lines that the people that were part of that audit are going to be subject to having a six-year look back thrown at them. So, you know, right now, if we look at the OIG work plan, some of the things that they have on there are things that we've seen in the past. So ventilators, for example, are still on that list. Off-the-shelf orthotic devices are on that list, and that one will likely add. We saw the one with Pacific Braces recently. I'm sure there's going to be some more. We also see power mobility devices, osteogenesis stimulators. So there's a number of products and services that are in the OIG work that we will probably see reports coming out of. But that's probably the best thing is just, you know, obviously be proactive and be prepared. Make sure you have, you know, a good compliance program and your employees are educated. They know what you mean, that you're doing spot checks and spot audits and documenting that. And then also familiarizing yourself with that work plan so you know when they identify something, if you're billing for it, that you got to be on the lookout for a potential audit from the OIG in this particular area, because now more than ever that response, because, you know, in this other one, it was one claim that was requested from these companies, so many of them probably didn't think much of it because it was just one claim. And yeah. Now, obviously, we're thinking a lot differently about it.
Okay, Wayne. Serious stuff, and obviously a topic that providers are going to want to learn more about. Where can they find out additional information? Do you have any speaking engagements coming up?
Yeah, of course. So, of course, we'll be at MedTrade Spring in Las Vegas, April 16th through 18th, and then the VGM Heartland Conference in Waterloo in June 10th through 12th. And then we're also at various state association meetings coming up. I know we'll be one for the Midwest as well as Alabama, so you can find those dates on our website at VanHalenGroup.com.
All right. Okay. Well, Wayne, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, David.
And I should add, that's not the last you'll be hearing from Wayne and Nikki. Thanks again to both of them for sharing their time and expertise. Okay, well, remember, if you want to stay on top of what's happening in the industry, make sure to check out hme-business.com and subscribe to our eSource weekly e-newsletter service. And if you haven't done so, make sure to subscribe to the print magazine there as well. Again, that address is hme-business.com. Of course, you can follow us on social media. We're at HME Business on both Facebook and Twitter, and I'm at Postacute News on Twitter. And there's this podcast. If you haven't already, please make sure to click the subscribe button so that you get every new episode. Remember, you keep listening and we'll keep posting. Okay, I think we'll wrap things up for this episode. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or requests, don't be afraid to reach out to me via Twitter on @PostAcuteNews or by email at dkopf@1105media.com. All right, thank you all very much for listening, and goodbye until the next HMEB podcast.